Welcome to Pax Europiana. This time already my first vaccination I had. Honestly, I had a little bit of not so good night with AstraZeneca, a little bit of headache and some kind of not so sleeping so well. And it was a bit cold. Anyhow, I'm happy I have it. And thanks a lot for modern science that we have a vaccine. And a night with bad sleep won't stop me from podcasting. But if I lose my thread this morning, I apologize and please bear with me. But now I will continue in this series about EU enlargement. I was thinking now I promoted EU enlargement, but it's also important to understand there might be some arguments against it. And some people might have legitimate arguments, yeah? They are my enemies, obviously, but I want to address them and I want to refute them. And I want to discuss systematically what could be the argument against it. What are some people saying? What are the politicians thinking? And what is around? And so I address them systematically. Because, you know, I'm in favor of enlargement. The three new countries, Albania, Montenegro and North Macedonia, they are in NATO and they are ready. In my view, they should join already 2024, and then the six other countries, once they have joined NATO and they have adopted the euro, and that's Ukraine, Moldova, Georgia, and Kosovo, Bosnia, Serbia. So we will have nine new countries. I'm not in favor of Turkey to join politically our union. Economically, we can integrate, yes, but these are the nine countries I promote. There can be also an option for the return of the United Kingdom, for Norway. That's all optional, but these nine countries are absolutely important, and there's a moral justification. Please listen to my previous podcast about the moral and economic and so other reasons for that. But somebody could say it's too early. The countries are not ready. The EU is not ready. We are all not ready. We don't want so much additional people. We don't want to care for them. We don't want to share our instruments with them, our solidarity. We are afraid of migration from Albania. We don't like Muslim countries. We perceive Albanians as Muslims. Yes, the EU is not ready. There could be also that point said. We are in a crisis. We have this institutional struggle between von der Leyen and Michel. We have not reformed the EU. We need a conference on the future of Europe in order to be ready. We are racist. That can be also. The country's economies could not be ready. They could be destroyed by the market competition of the EU market. These countries are corrupt. And so on and so on. This is some kind. It will be more complicated to unite Europe and to build further deepening because we have to take further interests into consideration. This could be some kind of line of reasoning and many of the arguments, yeah, that some people might say in Brussels, Berlin and Paris, and that might be the reason why we are stuck. First of all, we should not be racist. I think that's quite clear. We should also not be xenophobe. We should also not judge people by their religion, also not countries. It's also not in the fact that all Albanians are Muslims. Many of them are, in Kosovo most of them, in Macedonia, yes, most of them. In Albania, there's also Greek Orthodox Albanians, Catholic Albanians, about 60%. It's the same also in Bosnia. There's 2 million Bosnian Muslims. And, you know, there's also pockets of Muslims and Albanians and minorities in Montenegro and so on and so on. So that's the reality. Are we racist? Are we anti-Islam? Are we xenophobe? Do we have cultural prejudices? In these countries, they are not religious countries in a sense. It's the people who have various beliefs. Yeah. So I think that cannot be an argument. I think so. At least not for the European Union I want to belong to. So that's not a very good argument. Yeah. So the countries are not ready, let's say, technically regulatory. So what exactly do you think people like me have done the last 20 years in these countries? And the embassies, and the EU delegations, and these politicians, they have adopted Chinese standards in the last 20 years. Do you think it was American standards which were implemented? Interestingly enough, in Kosovo in the beginning, there was a bit of an unclarity and every advisor brought his own regulatory background from back home. So some people really promoted Indian standards, Wyoming standards, Arizona law, and whatever, Italian, and so on and so on. But in the meantime, it's all streamlined. What do you think in the last 20 years has happened? Obviously, these are all streamlined according to EU directives. Everything in Montenegro, that's already almost finished with the EU adaptation and with the negotiation process. Then it's also the situation with Albania. It's a regulatory alignment has happened. The same with North Macedonia. North Macedonia, so in the EU regulatory alignment, that's really a minimal work additionally to be done. Maybe there is something, there's always something to be done. Many things can also happen inside, yeah. It's not entirely necessary to get everything done, but the basic regulatory framework alignment has happened in all the three countries. So that cannot be a big topic. Let's discuss about corruption. Yes, you know, there is obviously corruption in Montenegro already much less. You know, they are quite good in the Transparency International ranking. Not perfect. There is more problem in Macedonia and in Albania. But the recent evaluations were rather positive. The EU has intervened heavily in the rule of law reforms in Albania, quite impressively. Since the government changes in 2016, the progress in the rule of law in Macedonia, quite extraordinarily, what the progress is. And it's not that the people there are incompetent in the prosecutor office, you know. There is obviously, they know exactly what to do. They played a big role also to get these things and the transformation done. So to believe that there is incompetence in the prosecutor office or in the judicial system, or there is no rule of law, that's a bit of a bizarre prejudice. There's a lot of European investments in Macedonia, Montenegro, Albania. I worked for some of them. And they wouldn't come if that would be chaos or disaster. There's obviously, it was difficult in the 2000s, yeah, no doubt. But now we are in 2021. Obviously, not everything is perfect. By the way, not everything is perfect also in Bulgaria and in Austria, by the way. We have a prosecutor, state prosecutor, still politically under the tutelage of the Minister of Justice. We have many problems in the rule of law in Austria. Should we kick Austria out of the European Union? Is that the idea? We have quite a lot of high level of corruption in Italy. So should we make whatever certified monitoring mission in Italy? We had huge corruption in the southern coastal towns of Spain. We have regular corruption scandals in Spain with party financing. Yes, we have recently a party financing scandal in Paris. Mr. Sarkozy had to answer a lot of unpleasant questions about Gaddafi, about the L'Oréal, and I think it's enough if I not continue. But I can, maybe there is some perfection between Estonia, Denmark and Sweden, where there is no corruption and no political party financing of dubious means and no Russian money laundering. You know, it's all possible that there is some perfection in some kind of northern fantastic countries, and I hope so. Germany is also less corrupt, it's true. But in all the southern European countries I know, and in Austria, and in all Eastern European countries, that's a major issue. You cannot say that the level is so much different in Albania, North Macedonia and Montenegro that this is the decisive criteria that you don't want to have it. You know, then we should really start a removal process of the Austrian state according to that one. And there is also a lot of issues with Hungary and, you know, with Poland. You know, we have massive issues because we didn't ever unify our judiciary. And that's one of the big issues, like the Americans have done early onwards, because they were from the beginning a state union and we are now only gradually building one. So you can say, let's wait. The idea, we first make Europe perfect, we build all the institutions, and then new countries can join us. But it's not really a very nice suggestion to let them outside, because we have to get our act together. What is the probability that we will work much better, much faster, and get all these things done recently, and then the countries, the poorer countries, they have to wait outside in the door, like the poor people in front of the door, and we are like sitting together, watching them fall outside, like now in the corona crisis, and we don't care. And then we say, we really have still a problem in Hungary, and so the enlargement didn't work, so Macedonia will be punished, or Albania, or Montenegro. I mean, how logic and how fair that is, I cannot understand. Let me come also to the functioning, because that's of course a big issue. The power distribution inside the European Union, the votes in the council and the votes in the parliament, the one commissioner for everybody, and all these privileges and possibilities of full membership. We just lost a country, the United Kingdom, so we are only 27. Now three countries won't like to join, then we would be 30 again. Do you, and also these countries are obviously much smaller altogether in terms of population. We're talking about Montenegro with 500,000 people, Albania maximum 3. We're talking with about 2 in Macedonia. So all in all, roughly 5.5 million people. The United Kingdom took 67 million European citizens with it away. So, and also they had a lot of seats in the European Parliament, yeah? So obviously it's three commissioners for all three of them. That might be too much. Yes, you know, I think, you know, I've not seen such a wonderful working situation with 27 recently. So will it make such a difference to have 30? Explain me. What is the difference between 27 and 30? That we have three more commissioners sitting around the table, I'm sure they will find the chairs for that. There will be also the places in the European Parliament. They don't have to build a new annex building. Will it be more complicated at the EU summits? I mean, much more complicated than now? Will the French see these new votes only as German proxy votes? You know, that's obviously one of the reasons. They always think that the new countries, which they opposed, will then later vote only with Germany. But, you know, there is some truth in that, that the countries don't forget. Like, I have never forgotten that the French were voting against Austria permanently when we wanted to join. Obviously, all elites will think about this for the long term, that the French have been so annoying and so obstructionist. But on the other hand, countries have national interests. They are not voting along German lines when Germany is in the north of Europe and they are in the south of Europe. They have a neighborhood with Greece, with Bulgaria, with Croatia, they with Italy. They have much more natural alliances with their neighbors, ultimately, when it comes to infrastructure, interest, investments, with all these big issues. Obviously, also, they are more aligned than with the other poorer countries, and they will also try to get more money. Now let's discuss about money. Can we afford? Should we afford? Is it very expensive to take 5.5 million people additionally in? Is that worth it? I mean, that's a question of generosity. Do we think we just want these people outside and we want them just as poor migrants to come to our shores and then work on the cheap labor market? Or do we want to treat them as real Europeans with all free movements? And all this level of respect, rights, prosperities, obligation, do we want to treat them as full Europeans? That's obviously a question. Do we also want to share the cost? By the way, this now we have just additionally mutualized 750 billion. The enlargement, we are anyhow funding, the IPA funding, and Montenegro, for example, is no longer so poor in relative terms. Albania has still the south, and the north is relatively poor, similar like Bulgaria, by the way, at about 27% of the EU GDP per average, there will be considerable investment done. But shouldn't we anyhow do that? Do we want to have countries that poor? And anyhow, the EU is not so generous actor in reality when you look how much redistribution is happening. It's not coming up to the, whatever, the German unification. No, no, no. So let's not exaggerate, and this one we really should, and we can, and we should also afford. Let's discuss, and again, about the institutional, you know, 30, then three more prime ministers. Again, an important question. Will they bring their regional issues alongside, and will they block the council? Will they be like Cyprus? Will they impose their foreign policy on the European Union, and will the European Union then have to take a lot of consideration on Albanian or North Macedonian or Montenegrin interest? Now, obviously, in a union, you have to take consideration for each member. That's obviously the case. But most of the issues which they have regionally are already settled with Greece, also with Bulgaria. Macedonia has anyhow to settle in order to join. And then, also Bulgaria, don't be so racist, by the way, and don't be so stubborn. But I hope there will be wisdom in Bulgaria. So then Albania as well, and that's the neighboring countries. They will be pro-Kosovo, yes, obviously, but we all should. Obviously, it will be not easier than for Serbia to join, because these countries will be already member. But on the other hand, they will be also very interested that Serbia joins, but also on some conditions. And here comes my point all along, that the most important criteria is obviously that countries are already in general geostrategically aligned with what we want to do. Obviously, in the EU, we have anyhow so many different perspectives on so many issues, so it's relatively easy to align. But what I in general refer to is the most important issue is obviously that they are a member of NATO. They are allies. That's the most important point. Because then you are part of this alliance, you reform your military, your secret service, you have the same geostrategic interests and kind of direction on the big issues. And obviously you are careful with the non-NATO powers, which have also interest in the Balkans, like Russia and China. And obviously that's very important, and that's a key issue, because we don't want a big China in the Balkans, we don't want a big Russia, a hostile power in every respect, to be in the Balkans a big power. Unfortunately, Serbia is anyhow very much an ally of Russia, and has bought a lot of Chinese equipment and does a lot of infrastructure projects like this railway to Montenegro now with Russian and Chinese support. I learned yesterday there is a new report about Chinese and Russian influence in the Balkans from CEPA, from the Center for European Policy Analysis. And that's a very recommendable report. And they are describing this very clearly. There's also the question about Turkish influence and also possible Islamist influence. Yeah, what we have seen and what I have seen and what I think is the common consensus, the Islamist influence in the Balkans is actually minimal. There was also studies, and during the height of the Syrian wars, there were some activists and fighters who were going, always in the level of maybe 200, 300 per country. That's, of course, unfortunate, but, you know, as I have said already, we should have easily intervened early in the Syrian crisis, because that disaster was like a cancer, also very divisive and had unfortunate effects. That's true. But now the situation is much calmer, and obviously this Islamist danger is not existing. And what we much more have a problem is that people from these countries get radicalized, but in Austria, in Switzerland, in Germany, because we have an issue with our immigration policy and with our integration policy. And once these countries are obviously member, their status in our societies will be very different as fellow EU members and with the same rights. They will not live on the margins in this kind of outskirts and suburbs and what kind of dangerous periphery and precariat. Will be full EU members and full fellow EU citizens. That will obviously, hopefully, avoid people drifting in some kind of Islamist terrorist level. That obviously has happened with this November 2020 terrorist. But with this measure, I think once they are living as full EU citizens, I think there will be much less kind of violent terrorism in this small extent what it actually exists. When it comes to China, the situation is also very worrying when it comes to the step traps and this famous Montenegrin highway and so on and so on. But the damage is already done, basically because we have never been so generous like we think of ourselves to be. The governments wanted to have infrastructure. It was justified to do it. The Chinese offered very cheap terms and very cheap building conditions. So they did it. Now, anyhow, we have to pay up bail them out, hopefully with some debt equity swap, as I proposed in this podcast many times. Yeah? But that the Chinese are building things in the Balkans is basically a sign just that we are somehow either not generous enough, not forthcoming enough, or we basically are idle onlookers on important developments, because that EU countries like Croatia cannot find EU funding and the EU companies to build their bridges and have to go to China. It's a bit confusing for me. So this report also outlines it very clearly that we have to do the things better, faster, and then the Chinese influence in the Balkans will be minimal. why don't we build this fast track from Budapest to Belgrade, which makes a lot of sense. I've called for it many times. So the Russian influence is obviously very much a different thing, and also the Russian military bases in Niš. You know, that's also very clearly why I call for Serbia first to join NATO. And that's obviously the most important geostrategic question. The second one, obviously, is the adoption of the euro, so that we don't have a case like we have it with Hungary now, where they don't want to join the euro and they somehow talk badly about their institutions. And we have basically locked them in some ways in the euro system. That's very important because it somehow makes also these political elites to wreak havoc on their people's prosperity much less dangerous. And also there's more transparency, there's less manipulation opportunities in the currency system. And it's a major factor for anti-corruption to have one currency. In Albania, in the long gone past, I was there 10 years ago, they had a central banker under his watch. The people were somehow, when the money was used and had to be burned, they thought it's wrong to burn it, and they didn't burn it and brought it back to the market. Yeah? So a lot of these things might happen if we don't look. So, sure, that was the past. But the euro is obviously the big tool of convergence, of anti-corruption, of clarity in the financial system, of stability, of anti-manipulation of the exchange rates. And it's a wonderful, important tool for progress. So these are the two conditions I think are very important. That's why I call for Albania and North Macedonia to adopt the euro, so they can move easily into the European Union altogether now in 2024. And yeah, let's discuss also, is the economy ready? That's also one issue which I hear very often. The economy of Albania might not be ready. The dangerous competitive pressures of the European internal market might destroy the Albanian production. Yeah, but that's a completely protectionist argument. What have consultants and advisors like me done in the last 20 years? And also these companies have now international partners. They want to sell to the European market. Then they have anyhow to have the same certificates, quality standards like it's general in the European Union. Otherwise, they couldn't sell. Nobody wants to only sell in Albania. It's very small markets. All these companies there, they want to sell to Italy, to Greece, also to export, obviously. So that's these countries are not ready. That I really cannot accept. And it's a fully protectionist argument, like Montenegro with 500,000 people would be just for Montenegro. And the Montenegrin company is just for Montenegro. It's certainly not like that. That's a complete confused argument. And also, the countries are more or less already in the internal market with the association agreement and all the other things. The protectionism is minimal in a way. They are already under the pressure of the international or European competitive market forces to 99%. So it's absolutely ridiculous. Let's come to migration. Some people might say, now, similar like Bulgaria, millions of people will go additionally from these three countries. They will be empty, they will be brain drained, that will be very hard. Already so many people have left because they lost the hope that there will be future. Then they go to Italy and to Austria from Albania, or from Montenegro they go in the rest of the world, yeah? Because they are very well educated, or they are less educated, but there is a demand for their labor in Italy or in Switzerland. There is really good pay. And then they leave, and so many have left, and so many will leave in additionally, no matter if they will be in the EU or not. Because why? Because the prosperity differential is still quite, and the income differential is huge between Switzerland or Austria or Germany and Albania, Montenegro and Macedonia and Greece. So obviously people look for their opportunities. But will everybody go? Let's discuss. By the way, is Romania empty? Is Bulgaria empty? Are there no poor people? Yesterday we discussed about 25% of the people in Bulgaria living below 250 euros per month. And then there was this big Twitter debate. Yes, but are they all moving to Germany? They could. They have all the rights. They could go tomorrow. But they don't. It's not that there is any legal obstacle for them. They have the free movement rights as European citizens. But they don't, because people don't choose to immigrate so easily. In a certain age, you know, when you are young, dynamic, and you want to earn something, you go easily in your 20s outside. But many people want to live with their families later in their life. they want to live in their country. They want to stay because they have property. They think they will have a future. They think they have this and this opportunity or other moral or social or personal reasons to stay. It's not that people suddenly move like tomorrow or everybody from Albania will move to Italy. Yeah? No, this is actually quite a nice country. Yeah? So I love it actually. Albania is very hard to leave. I was crying when I had to leave. Yeah, I shouldn't have gone to this television series and to tell Mr. Rama that he should keep the flat tax. Maybe that was maybe not a very good idea. Anyhow, that's a different story. But here, no, Montenegro, very beautiful. Macedonia, very beautiful. And that people leave for work, that's quite normal inside and outside of the European Union. And anyhow, they have all now already relatives in the European Union and they find their way into the EU systems once they are in this kind of position that they think it's now time to earn 10 years something. And obviously it's much better if they integrate it fully in the legal labor market, because we don't want all this informal, non-registered grey labor from the Balkans. That's of course complicated, but they're anyhow there. So it's much better to fully regulate them, as I have said already, for the pan-European open labor market. But it's much better they have also health certificates, health insurance. Now we know from the pandemic, it's much better they pay also insurances. They pay also, they have also decent health and safety measures. Yeah? It's very bad to have this kind of risks on this informal, illegal labor market, which many people take on themselves. And there a lot of things happened, which were really very terrible. So we don't want them. So the answer is not to block them and to remove them by police force, like Mr. Nehammer, the Austrian minister, is dreaming. But the answer is to include these countries in the European Union faster and open the labor market before. It's, I think, quite logical and it's beneficial. The reason why these people work here already is because there is work for their labor, for their skills, for the opportunities they provide. And, you know, it might be often very hard. And, you know, I personally don't want to put asparagus cutting in the spring fields. This is not, and some people want that and they earn and you can do it very well. It's also a skill you need to learn. And then our asparagus would not be fresh and so cheap without the Eastern Europeans and Southern European harvest help. So you can like this or not, but to forbid everything you don't like is not working economically in the real life. So that's much better to be open, much better to be inclusive. And the idea that there will be more people from Eastern Europe wanting to come, yes, but it doesn't really depend so much if the countries are in or not. They want to come anyhow, if they are in the right age and if they have the motivation to work abroad. Eh? But they come then as a kind of submarine, grey sector, illegal worker, and then for a lot of costs, yeah, on for them, they work illegally, and then Mr. Nehammer, the Austrian Interior Minister, sends at huge cost to the Austrian taxpayer, sends them back to Skopje or Tirana in an airplane with a police protection, and then 3 weeks later, they are anyhow in the bus back and go to Italy or to Greece, yeah, and so... I mean, this carousel is very expensive because this costs all a lot of money. This is a state action to find them, to supervise the markets and then to transport them back. And then for them, it's also very hard because then they have started to learn German, then they have to learn Greek and then they go to Portugal. I mean, we are really a bit messy on that one and we could be a bit more generous and a bit more human and a bit more serious, I think so. So which other arguments could be mentioned against it's too early, somebody is not prepared? Yes, in the conclusion, all arguments are that we are basically useless, helpless, and we are not willing because we are racist. It's not really that it would be a major problem to have 5.5 million people. And later it is, of course, a bit more complicated. You have to get Serbia, Kosovo, Bosnia, Ukraine, Moldova, Georgia. There's always strategic issues first to consider, currency issues to consider, political stability, peace. That I have said already many times. We need to euroize Serbia. We need also the same for Bosnia. We need this peace treaty. We need also to freeze the conflicts in Ukraine, Moldova, and Georgia in order to have a separate kind of membership for them, prior obviously with NATO membership and with euroization. So that all takes a bit more. and also the countries in Ukraine and Moldova and Georgia, and they are not so regulatory aligned still because we have rejected the EU potential candidate country, so they didn't get IPA funding, so they have missed the last 20 years of regulatory alignment. But with the DCFTA, a lot is happening already. But it's quite logical they need still for 2029 to join the EU fully. And obviously only once NATO membership and the euro adoption has happened. That is the two conditions. The rest we can solve also on the way. And we can also speedily integrate Kosovo, Bosnia, Serbia, Ukraine, Moldova and Georgia. Obviously it's possible in this time frame for 2029 European Parliament election, but it's not possible before. And it's also on the condition of NATO membership. That is obviously before, and I recommend and call also for euro adoption. And so a lot of progress can be done very fast, and that would be also very beneficial. But obviously that's more costly, because all in all we are talking then about 60 million people on with the six countries, which, and especially Ukraine with 37, and Georgia, Moldova, Serbia with 7. And so it's about 60 million people all in all. The 60 million people is a bigger step, you know, than the 5.5 million. So I say it's also important to do it in two steps, to first go with the smaller for 30, and then we have the big step for 36. Maybe Norway will also reconsider, and the UK, we will see what all is happening there. But the thing is, then we will be 37 countries, and we also maybe need then a bit of a different structure in the Commission, in the Council, but we don't need that for 30. You know, three more countries when we just lost one, because EU was working with 28, and so it will work with 30 as well. So there is no need for a new Senate-style direction. And I also don't see a lot of consensus. Maybe that is anyhow for the long-term future, to really reform the European Union towards the United States of Europe. Maybe that's also not on the agenda. Who knows, yeah? But that the country should join the European Union first, that's absolutely on the agenda. And that's absolutely a priority. And only Russian assets, racists and xenophobes can oppose that, as I have outlined. And I will call you on Twitter. All these things, if you oppose exactly this plan for European Union of 37 countries. 36, maybe. Good. These are all the things I now in my post-injection models have found that somebody could say against enlargement. I hope that I refuted all of them, because they are really very bad arguments. If any of them is really valid, please send me some feedback, contact me, write me an email or a Twitter message. I'm most happy. Give me a like at my YouTube channel and also subscribe to this podcast. I have some more interesting interviews lined up in the coming days. Always see the 1st of May is an absolute celebratory moment. It is the amazing day of EU enlargement 2004. I was celebrating at the Austrian-Slovenian border at the time with Dr. Rübig. He took me there, the parliamentarian from Austria, and I was working there in the SME Union times. And it was very special for me. And I have kept the spirit of the time, and I really enjoyed it. It was 17 years ago, and it was a big success, the enlargement of 2004. And we have to celebrate it all the time, and we have to make sure there is the same courage and the same wisdom and the same generosity and the same normality, because ultimately it's normal. We have built Europe for that, and that's what we do. We include all countries who want to join, and we reform them before, and we integrate them fast. And we continue to be very successful in this aspect of the European Union. And what is really not happening and working very well in Brussels, please, or in Paris, don't blame on the Eastern Europeans, please. And because this is very unfair and this is not justified. So thanks a lot for listening and for enlargement celebration 1st of May. More to come on this podcast to celebrate. Bye.